Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Professor Geoffrey Blainey makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. It's a couple of years since he was here. He's well known to all of you, but I'll introduce him briefly. Geoffrey Blainey is Australia's best-known historian. He's written nearly 40 books, including The Tyranny of Distance, Triumph of the Nomads, A Shorter History of Australia, Black Cattle and Full Moon, and the best-selling book, A Short History of the World. Anne and I were talking briefly to Michael Burley in London, who said that he was contemplating such a kind of work. He read Geoffrey Blainey's work and decided nothing more was necessary. So from a historian like Michael Burley, that's a pretty substantial compliment. And also, Geoffrey Blainey is one of the few living Australians whose biography appears in the Encyclopaedia Britannica. And on this occasion, Geoffrey Blainey is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of his most recent book, The Story of Australia's People, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Australia. Geoffrey Blainey, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, for the generous words. Members of the Sydney Institute, honoured guests, I wrote my first book in 1954. It was a book about mining on the west coast of Tasmania. It was called The Peaks of Lyell. And I looked at it for the first time for many years, and I noticed that there's one brief reference to Aborigines, who at one time spent large parts of the summer in that area. And it says simply, the years passed by and only the Aborigines heard the roar of the surf, and then they vanished from the picture. Nowadays we know much more about them and their important, decisive role in Australian history. When I was young, so little was known about the Aborigines, at least by European peoples. I think one of the problems is there was no chronology. Historians were at sea without a timeline, and with the invention of radiocarbon dating by the American Libby just after the Second World War, a new era opened in the study of Aboriginal history. By chance, and I had no interest in the topic, John Mulvaney was teaching ancient history at Melbourne University. It was 1956, and he thought that he should also look at the ancient history of Australia. And he arranged to conduct an excavation, only the second archaeological excavation ever conducted in Australia, at Fromm's Landing near Mannum in South Australia. That's just upstream from Murray Bridge. There was a cave and Aborigines had occupied it, obviously, for a long period of time and lit their fires, and there were remains of meals and there were layers of ash until the cave became so high that you had to crouch to be in the cave. Underneath was history. He was, in those days, people didn't have much money, and he had perhaps 10 people to go on his archaeological expedition, and he was short of transport. I had a car, and he said, "Well, I come on the expedition." I carried 6 of the 10 people, if that was the number. In those days, travel was simple, and we stopped at Border Town, or rather, we stopped at Keith the first night. We travelled a long way, and we reached Mannum the second day. There was the cave all ready to be excavated. I didn't at first take much interest in the excavation. I chopped the wood, and I looked after the fire, and sometimes I cooked the meals. It was all very simple. But the excavation went on, and was done with incredible thoroughness. People were using sometimes toothbrushes and trowels so that nothing would be disturbed unnecessarily. Eventually they sent away to the United States specimens of carbon, and they found that the cave had been inhabited at least 5,000 years ago. That caused a mild sensation. I don't think anybody realised that the Aborigines had been here so long. In fact, some people thought they might have been here only in the Christian era. John Mulvaney then went on to do further work, and he went to a place called Kenneth Cave in central West Queensland and excavated there, and to his delight pushed back the date for the first human occupation of Australia another 10,000 years. He said he received the message over the flying doctor radio while he was eating porridge and golden syrup. In our era of coffee shops and cafes everywhere, you don't see much golden syrup around anymore. But it was the delight of a large section of Australia's population when our nation was poorer. In 1968, a remarkable event happened. Jim Bowler from the Australian National University was a specialist on sand dunes and how they moved and how they were formed. And he was in southwestern New South Wales at Lake Mungo, and he found, disturbed perhaps by the winds, human remains. The remains were eventually identified and dated, and they were remains of an Aboriginal woman who died perhaps 24,000 years ago and had been cremated. I think at the time that was the oldest known evidence of cremation, ceremonial cremation in the world. She was a young girl, gracile was the phrase it used to describe her. He then, a little time later, perhaps 2 years later, found the remains of a man. The man had been ceremonially buried and had been dusted or painted with red ochre. There's no ochre in the vicinity, so the ochre had come a long time away. Here was a ceremonial burial of great importance in wider human history, not just in Aboriginal history. I've met Jim Bowler occasionally, but just for short conversations, and we had lunch this month, and we got talking, and he came from Leongatha, born the same year as I did, and I said, "What part of Leongatha did you live?" Oh, he said, "We came from County Kerry, and we had a farm just outside Leongatha on the Melbourne Road." I told him that I lived in Leongatha at the same time in this tiny little town. My father carried the Methodist banner in Leongatha, so he didn't have so many Catholic connections. I didn't ask him whether he went to the convent. I don't think he went to the state school, which I attended, a wonderful state school where we learned everything by chanting. 3 times 3 is 9, and so forth. And I still carry the chanting in my mind and will as long as I live. It means I can go to a shop and add up. It was a remarkable discovery, and I should be careful because we were just talking privately and off the cuff. He was really a kind of a prospector. Saw something unusual, a clue, wondered about it. Did a little more work. I have the great prospectors of Australia, we think of them as ordinary people, but many of them had highly intellectual minds, even though they were trained in no particular discipline. They looked for clues and wondered if why certain clues which were not expected were there, and I suppose that's what he did. Almost in the space of a couple of years, the human history of Australia, which was believed to be so short, was pushed back 24,000 and perhaps 40,000 years. Now they say that the woman, the Aboriginal woman uncovered at Lake Mungo was perhaps died 40,000 years ago. We all know, many of us here are in the age group where we used to say Australia has had no history, and one of the reasons we loved to go overseas was to see history. But here was history of enormous length. Of course, here suddenly was a date, here was a great map of Australia, but there were no events in it. But soon the events were found. Australia 40,000 years ago, and incidentally, there have been no older burials, no older bones of Aborigines found since then. Nobody would have predicted that in the next 45 years there would be no further Aboriginal remains as old as that. Presently people speak of the Aborigines being here 50 or 60,000 years, but there are great arguments about the evidence and the technology that's being used. Eventually, we'll have greater knowledge. It's a boom industry, the study of Aboriginal history, and knowledge will keep on being created. Australia, of course, had many events which have only been unravelled in more recent years. in primary school, and there's great interest in Aboriginal history there. They tend to teach that the Aborigines lived in harmony with nature, and I suppose that's good for little children if they're going to be taught. But of course the Aborigines are human beings like us, and no human beings live in complete harmony with nature. If your technology is strong, of course you will alter nature and maybe do harm or maybe do good, but you'll do a lot of harm. There were extinctions of remarkable creatures in Aboriginal times. The Diprotodon, the size of a rhinoceros, became extinct. The evidence is now pretty clear after the Aboriginals arrived here. In so many parts of the world, the arrival of human beings was accompanied by the extinction of unusual species. It may be that the human beings didn't actually commit the extinction. It may be that they were present when the climate was changing, or something they did indirectly led to the extinction of creatures. That remarkable animal, the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, could be seen 10,000 years ago in New Guinea. It could be seen in many parts of Australia 4,000 years ago, including the Nullarbor Plain. The last Tasmanian tiger was believed to have died in the Tasmanian Zoo in the 1930s, in my lifetime and the lifetime of other people here. It's remarkable that such a creature should have lasted so long and eventually gone. I was once, interestingly, on a government committee with Vincent Cerventi, the naturalist in northwest Tasmania, and a man in the audience said he believed he'd seen a Tasmanian tiger under the headlights in 1938, a few years after the official extinction. And Vincent Cerventi said the evidence was overwhelming that what he'd seen was one of the last of the Tasmanian tigers. Of course, Australia was so different than 60,000 years ago, or certainly 40,000 years ago. Australia was very cold. Canberra possibly had the temperatures in winter that Mount Kosciuszko has today. In many parts of Australia, the vegetation was bleak, and I think current research, and I stand correction, is that the eucalyptus, now so plentiful in so many parts of Australia and in such varieties, the eucalyptus was hardly to be seen in Australia 25,000 years ago. It spread when the climate became warmer. About 18,000 years ago, and that's very recent in human history, the Aborigines had been here for at least 30,000 and perhaps 40,000 years. 18,000 years ago, the seas began to rise. They began to rise, of course, all over the world. A period of global warming such as would make anything predicted for the next 20 years or the next 1,000 years in Australia seem like a mere bubble on the sea. I don't say that in any way disparaging either for or against the argument on global warming, but here was an event on an astonishing scale. 18,000 years ago, and there were no world travellers then. If you were a world traveller, you could have walked from Yorkshire to Estonia and Latvia. There was no North Sea. You could have walked from Bali to Beijing. You couldn't have walked from Bali to Lombok because that was deep water. Had been there for an enormous period. If you lived in Australia 18,000 years ago, you could walk from Sydney to Port Moresby, no Torres Strait. If you lived in Sydney 18,000 years ago, you could walk to Hobart, no Bass Strait. I suppose if you lived in Sydney 18,000 years ago and you stood where the Opera House is now, there would be a river well below making its way out to sea, out through North Head and South Head, and eventually reaching the sea well to the east. Adelaide, of course, was a long way from the sea. Melbourne was a long way from the sea. If you were an Aborigine and you made a bark canoe in Melbourne, there was, of course, no Port Phillip Bay. Port Phillip Bay came very late in Aboriginal history, and you could paddle the canoe down what is now Port Phillip Bay, close to the Mornington Peninsula, the Arab Boy carrying you on through Port Phillip Heads, no sea. You then went to the south or the southwest, the Barwon River joined you from Geelong, then before long the Tamar joined you from Tasmania. The Tamar was a mighty river and much stronger than the Yarra, because in summertime the snow and ice was melting in the highlands of Tasmania and filling the Tamar River. And then the combined Yarra, Barwon and Tamar sailed southwest and eventually reached the ocean west of King Island. Of course, Perth was much closer to the sea, relatively close to the sea, but not on the sea, nor Fremantle. Darwin, a long way from the sea. Darwin, a very long way from the sea. Brisbane, fairly close to the sea, but nowhere near the sea. And so Australia was so different. It must have been a remarkable event, the rising of the seas, going on rapidly for thousands of years and then slowly, and ending about 6,000 years ago. You get some idea of how quickly the sea came in at Townsville, where the gradient of the land was relatively gentle. The sea, they say, came in about 10 metres a year. If you come in 10 metres a year, that means 10 years, 100 metres, and if it continues on, what, in 100 years? Just imagine the rising of the seas. How many special sites, how many hunting grounds, how many places where you gathered vegetables were all inundated forever. I mean, every Aboriginal group that lived by the sea lost all or part of its land in the face of this great event. To my mind, and a lot of people don't agree with me, it is by far the most important event in the history of Australia. The rising of the seas, beginning 18,000 years ago, is the most important single event in the human history of Australia. I can't see anything since 1788 that can compare to it in the magnitude of its effects. And so, bit by bit, the climate became warmer, the map of Australia changed, people moved inland and inland. How they got on with one another, one doesn't know. Occasionally, no doubt, it happened slowly and they lived together in some kind of harmony. Occasionally, no doubt, they fought, but we don't have evidence for this. We'll know much more about that, but we've got no idea what will be invented. But of course, the key evidence for this period is buried beneath the ocean, because you can't be sure that someday somebody will find a technique to find campfires or some remains, even the tiniest remains on the ocean floor, which will give clues to this astonishing event in Australian history. Of course, this meant that Australia was cut off from the world. It was cut off from New Guinea. Timor was much further away than previously it had been. Asia was much further away. Not completely cut off, but made relatively isolated. While this was going on in the last phase in the Middle East and later in other parts of the world, a mighty revolution was occurring. They call this the Neolithic Revolution. I suppose the best way of calling it is to say it's a gardening revolution. The human beings began to domesticate plants and animals. Human beings began to domesticate grains and grow grains. They began to domesticate the sheep, the goat, and so forth. It's a remarkable event in human history. In some ways, I suspect, it's more important than the Industrial Revolution. Previously, hunters and gatherers, as Aborigines were nomadic. The Aborigines today don't like the word, and a lot of scholars don't like the word. They think it's derogatory, but it's still the best word. If you want to, you can say semi-nomadic, but nomadic is, I think, the best word. And here were people who, with great knowledge of their own environment, moved around systematically according to the seasons, collecting plant food and killing game, birds and fishes and so forth, and doing it with great skill. I admired what I found out about and what others have found out about that society, how skillful it was and what a good standard of living they had in good years by the standards of the time. We don't know, incidentally, enough about the Aboriginal climate. A remarkable article appeared in December. It just came in enough time to squeeze it into my book. The drilling of ice cores in the East Antarctic tells you a lot about the climate in the parts of the Pacific not too far away. And a team of geophysicists and allied scientists reported that Australia in the 12th century of the Christian era, was very dry, especially the eastern half of Australia, with, of course, much the larger population. It was very dry. On top of that dryness came a drought which began in 1174, about the time of the Crusades. About 1174 came a drought that lasted 39 years. I don't know how the Aboriginal population would fare in that drought. There would be some areas where they would manage having access to the fish of the sea and so forth, they would manage. But inland, it must have been catastrophic. I mean, some people say that the Aboriginal population perhaps reached 1 million by 1788. I have great doubts about that. I think if a climatic event like that hits people who can't hoard food, who collect food daily, the effect on their population must have been dramatic and traumatic. The domestication of plants and animals, of course, is the domestication of people. Anybody who keeps a cat or a dog knows that. It's a two-way relationship, isn't it? What it does to people, it imposes a work discipline. It imposes a work discipline. You have to plant each year. You have to hoard the seed. You have to either fence off your gardening plot or you have to guard it. The gardening revolution, I'm pretty sure, is accompanied by a political revolution. The two go hand in hand. The political revolution consists of a division of labour, people becoming specialists, priests, farmers and so forth, professional soldiers for the first time, powerful rulers, and territories infinitely larger than previous territories. We know that in Aboriginal Australia in 1788 there 200 or 300 what Aborigines like to call now nations, and I think there's some merit in the word. Tribes is a word that previously was used, but here were these people with relatively small groups, no powerful ruler, no professional army. The effect is unmistakable. The organising ability, the power to conquer of a country or a group of people that have undergone the gardening revolution increased enormously. There was no way in the end that the nomadic people living in their relatively small political units could defeat a country which had undergone the gardening revolution. I think this, to me, and many may disagree, this was a great problem in Aboriginal Australia. They never went through the gardening revolution. In some ways they were lucky. In some ways the quality of individual life might have been better in the old hunter-gatherer day, a more interesting life. On the other hand, your economic power and your military power are much smaller. If you look at the history of the countries near Australia, the gardening revolution came to New Guinea. It came to New Guinea thousands of years ago. Not only all kinds of plants cultivated in village gardens, but pigs. The gardening revolution came to New Zealand. What is it, less than 1,000 years ago? Not a sophisticated form of a gardening society, but definitely a gardening society. It came to the Torres Strait Islands, but it didn't come to Australia. I think, and people may disagree, but to me the evidence is overwhelming, it's much easier for a society that has gone through the gardening revolution to cope with another society that's also had the gardening revolution than to cope with a nomadic society. The nomadic society is so difficult to understand. So my belief is that when in 1788, when in Sydney, the nation which had just invented the steam engine came face to face with representatives of the hunter and gatherers, and of course we're all descendants from hunter and gatherers, but here are the Aborigines occupying, I suppose, the largest section of the earth, still occupied by hunter-gatherers, and here they're face-to-face with these people who've not only gone through the gardening revolution, but gone through other revolutions and have the steam engine and the political organisation that goes with the hoarding of food and so forth. My view is that there is no way in which these two people meeting each other in Sydney in 1788 could have understood each other at first. Even if you brought out, instead of the convicts and marines from the British Isles, the great philanthropists and scientists, the great women and men of the British Isles, and set them ashore in Sydney Cove, and they met culls from all over Australia, the cleverest Aborigines, the most humane and compassionate Aborigines, and you put them side by side, how at first could they understand each other? Even if they had a common language, how could they understand each other? Different attitudes to food, different attitudes to relationships, different attitudes to families, different attitudes to land. It's a great gulf, and to some extent, our nation is still in the shadow of that gulf. A large part of the gulf has been narrowed, but we're still in the shadow of that gulf. Interestingly, it was much easier. It was much easier for the British coming to New Zealand to negotiate with the Maoris, because the Maoris had been through the Gardening Revolution. Much easier to negotiate. You couldn't have possibly had a treaty of Waitangi with Australia at that time. How would you negotiate it? In any case, the various Aboriginal groups were not necessarily allies with one another. There's no way you could draw a treaty which either would understand. An interesting little comment. I was in the Constitutional Convention in 1998 in Canberra. There were a considerable number of Aboriginal representatives there, many of them eloquent, and I think all of them Republican. There was one representative from the Torres Strait, the Gardening Society, Mr. George Mai. And when Mr. George Mai was puzzled that they thought he should be seated next to Aborigines because he was not a Republican, but he made his speech. It wasn't very much reported, which was a great pity. He said, the great thing in the history of the Torres Strait Islands was the coming of the Europeans. He called it, as they call it, the coming of the light. In 1871, the London Missionary Society, I think a mixture of Anglican and Congregationalist largely from London, with enormous influence across the Pacific Ocean, sent missionaries from the Loyalty Island to the Torres Strait Islands, and before long the Torres Strait Islanders were members of the London Missionary Society. You couldn't imagine something like that happening in Aboriginal society. George Mai said, if you go to Torres Strait, if you go to Thursday Island, and you see the very handsome cathedral on the hill, the Quetta Memorial Cathedral, no longer a cathedral, in front of us a monument to celebrate the coming of the light, the great event. Of course, the Torres Strait Islanders ceased to be the London Missionary Society and they became Anglicans. The Queen, the head of the Anglican Church, and they thought the Queen was an important part of their culture. Now, I don't want to generalise too far, but those are the kinds of differences you see in people who are hunters and gatherers and people who have gone through the gardening revolution. And there are differences that we don't, I suppose, fully understand. It turned out in many ways a tragic meeting. The dividends are now coming to the Aborigines and especially in the last 40 years, but the early history of the British in Australia was in many ways tragic. They believed at first that from both sides that they might get on, and the more benevolent governors, whether in South Australia or New South Wales or elsewhere, believed that if they could only teach the Aborigines to farm and only teach them to read and write, they would fall in with this civilisation. But the Aborigines had no interest and the economics of the civilisation which came into them. And some people say, well, the Aborigines weren't intelligent enough to take advantage. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. In some of these schools, the Aborigines were the top. But after a while, they left. Their parents called for them, or they thought something interesting is going on elsewhere, and they left. And everywhere the schools did not have anywhere near the success that they hoped for. Attempts were made to teach Aborigines to farm, and occasionally they took great interest in it. Before long, it wasn't interesting. They had a way of life that they knew, and all their traditions surrounding it, and they wanted to keep it. And this is the remarkable thing, isn't it, that the Aborigines didn't clamour to belong to this society except for the food. There was no real political movement in Aboriginal Australia to become part of this society. The Maoris got the vote in 1867 and wanted it in Australia. Would this be right? I'm John Hurst. Until the 1930s, there's no articulate Aboriginal movement wanting the franchise, except perhaps a little in South Australia.
So some Aborigines did have it.
Yes, they did. Oh, yes, and you've written about it. Yes, so many Aborigines had the vote in Australia. At a time when they were said not to have the vote. So here's this this sad position. So many Aborigines killed by European action, and although the number of Aborigines who were killed by fighting is relatively small compared to the number killed by diseases to which they had no immunity, whether smallpox or diphtheria or measles or so forth. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. The great decline in Aboriginal population, the tragic decline that took place between 1788 and about the 1920s, was due to diseases to which they had no immunity. I think the sad thing is that large numbers of Aborigines believe that the population declined largely through killing. The understanding of history on the two main streams in Australia has still got a long way to go. So we must have time for questions. To my mind, here are two key events in Australian history which ultimately, as a nation, we should keep in our mind. The first event is that the rising of the seas was a colossal event that transformed Australia, gave us the present map, made the land in many places much more habitable and much more productive. At the same time, because it was represented the isolating of Australia from places which were once contiguous, it meant that Australia, not completely isolated from the world, was largely isolated at the time when the world was changing rapidly. And the second event was that the Neolithic Revolution, or the Gardening Revolution, of such profound importance around the world, did not come to Australia. And in economic and political terms, the Aborigines suffered, although in cultural and spiritual and other terms, they may even have gained. So I'm saying that there's one event that did happen of enormous importance in understanding a history, and there's one event that didn't happen, also of enormous importance in understanding our history. My hope, and it will come, is that the average Australian, whether in 50 years' time or 100 years' time or 200 years' time, will see Australian history as one and will have intense interest in that long period of Aboriginal history stretching back 60,000 years, and will know a lot about it, and will also have much greater knowledge than at present of that period of Australian history which began in 1788. And we'll see that what those two parts have in common and in what ways they're different. My own view is that the only real path to reconciliation in Australia is to realise how difficult it was when these two cultures and these two people, so far apart, were brought together in 1788. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Professor Blaney. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of The Story of Australia's People, The Rise and Fall of Ancient Australia, which is volume one of two volumes.
I'm going to write one more.
Yeah, this is the first, and the second one will go from the gold rushes to the prison. This goes to the mid-19th century. So we're coming to question and discussion. Thanks to Cause Chambers Westcar for the use of this fine facility this evening, and we've got till the top of the hour. So you mentioned your first book, which I read many years ago, The Pigs of Lyle, and this your most recent book. Tell us about, as a historian, how difficult is this kind of book, because you have access to archaeology, but for the rest you're dealing really with the tradition of a people that didn't have a written language.
Yeah.
So how do you work out what stands and what's mythology and what's what's history along the kind that you would have regarded as history when you wrote your first book 60 years ago?
Yes. The question is, writing about modern Australia, where often there's a surfeit of evidence. You don't say it when you're writing a book, but often there is a surfeit of evidence. There's more evidence than you can read. And when you're writing about Aboriginal history and, to a lesser degree, Torres Strait Islander history, there are so many gaps. After all, they couldn't read, they couldn't write. They could count, but not counting in our sense, I think. Well, Aborigines didn't know that there were 10 people here or 20 people or 30 people here. They would know the names of everybody and therefore would have a very accurate measure of roughly of how many people there were without counting them. To me, this is... I came as an outsider. I first wrote on Aboriginal history in 1975. The book was called Triumph of the Nomads. And I found it exciting partly because of the lack of evidence. There were many places there were evidence, but you had evidence, if you were interested in how they lived, you had evidence of what they did in 1788 when they were faithfully observed, or in 1830 when they were faithfully observed. You had evidence of that, but you couldn't be sure how far you could push that evidence back to 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. So you had to use your imagination, and you always have to use your imagination to some degree in writing history. But I found it exciting, the lack of evidence, and that's the reason I became so interested in the rising of the seas and its effect on Australia. Archaeologists had no evidence and therefore wouldn't touch it, quite rightly, being scholars, and other disciplines not having the evidence wouldn't touch it. But I thought, how can an event as important as this affecting so many lives and transforming them, even though we've got no evidence, how can you possibly leave it out? And so I tried to reconstruct what had happened. I mean, a lot of people disagreed with me and said I shouldn't, but I think ultimately it will be accepted. What I'm saying is really so elementary that ultimately scholars who want evidence everywhere, that they'll have to say, well, even though we have to work hard in the absence of evidence, important events take place and change the world even though there's no evidence, or much, not much evidence remaining. That's special pleading, forgive me.
So, sorry, I missed it. Geoffrey, tell me where you're looking, down here.
There's a man with his hand high up there.
Oh, sorry. There we go. Okay.
Professor Blaney, thank you so much. I'm a little bit biased towards your Triumph of the Nomads. I've read it about three or four times. Do you know there are schools in Australia which are using it in their history lessons as an official reference book and educational book?
There's Triumph of the Nomads still being used in schools or universities?
It may be here and there by a teacher who hasn't got access to a good library, but I would think it's not being used in. It became out of date, of course. I updated it slightly, but not enough, and the last edition came out in probably the mid 1990s, and understandably, they turned to other books. But it was, of course, widely used in the 1970s and 1980s, and I think had a very strong influence at that time. But people were right to move away from it. But I'm glad I've come back to it, difficult as it is, and tried to rewrite the story and bring it up to date. And it's easier to do this in the new age of printing and the new age of everything. That's probably the biggest rewriting of a history book that's ever taken place in Australia. Well, that doesn't give me much credit. But it's also a sign of how much research has been done in that field and how intense the interest is in finding out more.
The concept of sharing, which is so central to Aboriginal culture, seems to me to be the one thing that's so misunderstood by Western culture,
yeah,
and on which so much of the conflict arose.
Yeah.
Could you
speak about the concept of sharing in Aboriginal culture?
Yes, the speaker made a very valuable point that in Aboriginal culture, in the Aboriginal extended family, the sharing of food or the sharing of possessions or the sharing of shelter is a much more sophisticated and much more developed and much more an obligation than it is in our society. The emphasis that sometimes is placed in Australian history on the concept of mateship still falls a bit short of the Aboriginal sense of obligation within the family. On the other hand, the Aboriginal sense of obligation outside the family is not so strong. You don't see any Aboriginal philanthropy to people outside their own kin. But a society which had this strong sense of obligation is very difficult. It's very difficult for a materialist culture like ours. If you're going to be a farmer, and some Aboriginals attempted to be farmers and did very well, but often they came to grief on the relatives would come in and say, you've got food there, you've got grain, but he said, that's my seed for next year. But there's an obligation, and even today in many outback places where the Aboriginal traditions are most powerful. Sharing is a powerful obligation, isn't it? But it makes it very difficult for somebody to save. And our society, especially in the 19th century, put an enormous emphasis on saving. And it was one of the secrets of our society's success. You couldn't have new technology, you couldn't have all kinds of things without saving, whereas saving is in many ways inimical to certain powerful facets of Aboriginal culture.
You explained it very well, and it's always seemed to me that in 1788, nowhere else in the world in the whole of its history has there been such an extreme contact between two different groups.
Yeah.
The height of the British Empire meeting with the hunter and gatherer Indigenous Australians. And it would seem to me that with that enormous difference, you would have expected maybe one would have completely wiped out the other.
Yeah.
What was there in the coming together that was more, that was some of the positives? I mean, was there something in the perhaps advanced culture of Britain that stopped that?
Why is it that the Aborigines weren't extinguished? In many sections of Australian society, there was, of course, goodwill towards Aborigines. I think that virtually all the people who went out of their way to try to set up institutions to feed or to teach Aborigines were made not just by Christians but by devout Christians. I think while it's out of favour at the moment in our more secular age, the 19th century is a remarkable example of the way in which considerable numbers of Christians in Australia believe that they had an obligation to do things for Aborigines, and we also forget that in a period where social services were few and welfare was few, often the Aborigines were receiving more welfare than were the European peoples themselves. That's now forgotten. There's something in the present climate, and understandably there's a lot of, I shouldn't say understandably, it's complex hostility to Christian activities, but it's worth thinking that in 1900 in Australia, the typical Australian town or suburb gave far more to Aborigines from their own savings than was given today. The typical Australian town and suburb in the 19th century or in 1900 gave far more to Aborigines from their own savings than was given by the typical Australian town and district today. We say, well, we've got the government. But in the 19th century, they said, well, it's our obligation to do it. And that's something that's been forgotten. I've researched it, but I'm not completely sure whether I've got all the details. Just a simple little example of often where there's goodwill that in ways that we don't quite appreciate. An Aboriginal from the Coopers Creek area, where Burke and Wills met their fate, was convicted of murder, but was given a shorter term of imprisonment. Indeed, was not hanged because he committed murder in self-defence. He came down to Adelaide and served his term in the labour prison at Adelaide, and in the 1880s he escaped. Shots were fired, but they didn't get him, and his desire was to return to his homeland. And he set out travelling by night. I don't think he had anything at first, but he called at a house and they gave him a suit, a brown suit, which presumably he wore barefoot. Somebody, he wanted a tomahawk, and they gave him another house, gave him a tomahawk, another the knife. He needed a water carrier, so he killed a possum and gutted it, and that became his water carrier. He says that wherever he called, and he was known to be on the run, and he said, well, his name was Logic. I don't know why it was called Logic. That was his nickname. In these irrational days, we'd all love to be called Logic. So, but wherever he called, and he could only travel at night, trackers were out, black trackers, who were remarkable detectives, weren't they, the Aboriginal detectives. People were looking for him, but he'd call at the place, and they would give him food. And he waded his way up past Port Augusta, on foot, of course, eventually captured with the aid of black trackers in the Blinman Range, near Blinman or in the Flinders Rangers. And when he was interviewed after his capture, he paid tribute to all the people along the way in law-abiding South Australia. And some people must have told the police, but they didn't tell the police in such a way as he would be captured. Now the picture of relations between Aborigines and Europeans is emphasised very much on the clashes and the poor points, but there's an enormous amount of friendly contact and good contact alongside the poor relations, but somehow in the present state of history that's not reported as much as it should be.
There's a question, you've got to be brief when you come here.
Do we know when and how and where from the Aborigines came to Australia?
Where did the Aborigines come from? I mean, the belief is that they came from Southeast Asia when the sea levels were lower, so that the islands were much closer together. They came through Bali and so forth. It's not known whether they made their first landfall in northwestern New Guinea, which was then part of the continent, Greater Australia, or whether they made their landfall in the Kimberley or some part of the present Western Australian coast. Maybe we'll never know. I've long been an advocate of a monument being set up in Canberra to honour the first Aboriginal discoverers of Australia, but nobody's ever taken it up, and it seems to me to be a very sensible gesture, both in the interest of history and the interest of truth, but I suppose the problem of New Guinea and Australia in the eyes of many Aborigines would be damaging to them, and it's never been followed through. But they don't necessarily need to have come when the sea levels were lower. Probably they did, and then they spread all around the continent in every climatic zone, settling some places that we as Europeans have never settled. The Aborigines, of course, believe that they've always been here. That's what large numbers of Aborigines say, that we've always been here. This has always been our land. I don't think the evidence favours that there. Yeah. They've come here as migrants.
There's a question here. Yes.
And you asked about what was good. And I'm interested, Geoffrey, you said that it's an Aboriginal, within Aboriginal families sharing. I don't know if you've heard of Gaynor McDonald's work about demand, what she calls demand sharing.
Gaynor McDonald.
She's writing his
about demand sharing.
No, I haven't. No.
Right. Well, sorry about this, but it's not that the family, you within the group, certain people have rights, but even within a very small group, certain people have rights. And her idea is that what is happening now to Aboriginal people is that because you are within an Aboriginal, because Aboriginal society is not interested in production. The thing that it produces is relationship. The Aboriginal culture produces relationship. So when you are in a demand-sharing relationship, you exist because you are in relationship with another person. Mm. And what we are doing now, because when we set up...
We've got to be brief here.
Yeah, we will. Yeah. When we set up trusts and things, it's an absolutely crucial thing to understand.
Yeah.
We are imposing our own set of correct procedures, but we are putting Aboriginal people in the situation where they have to deny the culture, and that's the worst thing, she thinks, that has ever happened.
Yeah.
It will actually utterly destroy people, and just what explains the drinking and the so-and-so now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's worth looking at it.
Yeah. What's the first name of the
Daniel.
Gaynor McDonald.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate the comment. Yeah, but this is in the nature, isn't it, of two different cultures facing one another. It's almost inevitable that one will try to impose its world on the other. And if we here had all been in a ship and the ship came ashore in 1666 on the coast of Western Australia, and Aborigines took us up, or various groups of Aborigines took us up, they would quite rightly impose their culture on us, wouldn't they? But we should by now be more alert to the differences in the cultures and see ways in which we can jump over difficult streams.
There's a question down the back.
Yes, Professor Brady, thank you for sharing your thoughts. In relation to your comments concerning the absence of an agricultural revolution, I'm wondering, firstly, whether that is completely the case, and secondly, whether that's not, in fact, a proxy for an absence of other levels of social organisation and so forth, which would sustain an agricultural society. Mm. I'm thinking of things like fish traps,
yeah,
burning off of country, habitual use of the
yeah,
same country, and even, in fact, increase rituals,
yeah,
which were, might be taken as a form of agriculture, albeit nowhere near as developed as
yeah,
the English system.
Mm.
I just wonder whether
yeah,
the focal point of agricultural society is not looking at an effect rather than something that has wider
yeah, causes. Yeah, I appreciate very much that comment. There's no doubt about it that there was great ingenuity in Aboriginal food gathering in many parts of Australia, whether in the fish traps or whether in the burning off of large areas so that the young grass would come up. There's no doubt about it, and some forms of that ingenuity are probably not seen or documented in other parts of the world. And since there is ingenuity on a considerable scale, some scholars of Aboriginal life say, well, the Aborigines were moving slowly towards their own gardening revolution, but coming in a different way. And I'm quite happy with that interpretation. The only thing is that the gardening revolution, as we know it, is also accompanied by a political revolution. And there's no sign of that political revolution in Aboriginal life. But maybe their kinds of advances didn't need a political revolution. After all, if you're burning off the grass, you don't need a fence, do you? It's the last thing you want. Yeah. But there is a very dedicated school of research which says the Aborigines were making their own way. Well, they wouldn't. My belief is yes. You can't deny the ingenuity of their economic life, but whether they would reach the position where their small political units would merge, and that's what really what I think they had to do if they were going to defend this country. There was no chance of them merging, and unless you had merging, they were at the mercy of invaders, and they couldn't even negotiate successfully. If you can't negotiate with your own next-door neighbours on a permanent basis, it's pretty hard to negotiate with an outsider. Yeah. But I continue to marvel when I read it. The Aboriginal way of life and the ingenuity of it. Technology, absurdly simple. You can't display it in a museum. The technology is almost nothing. But the use of knowledge is really very, very impressive in traditional Aboriginal society.
Now we're getting closer to the end. There's a question here.
It's just I accept the clash of societies in 1788, was it a homogeneous society that was being clashed with? You know, you talked about all those tribes and nations who didn't respect different languages, fought with each other. Did they all have the same beliefs and understanding?
The suggestion is there was a clash of civilizations,
yeah,
but there was one yeah, group wasn't actually a civilization, it was many civilizations, I think.
Yeah.
Were they homogeneous?
I think many people would say culturally, there are surprising similarities between the far north of Australia and the far south, or in their spiritual beliefs, very considerable similarities in the family relationships, very considerable similarities, so that culturally they have much in polygamy. After all, they had many wives, didn't they? I'm not sure whether that was true in Tasmania, but in most parts of Australia the evidence for it is pretty strong. Yeah. So they had great unity and great divergence. Mm.
So as a final question... Oh, James, okay.
Jared Diamond thinks that you couldn't have a farming revolution in Australia because there was virtually nothing suitable to farm, either plants or animals. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that. But it may be that there weren't a sufficient number of suitable applicants in Australia to make it easily achieved. But I think a lot of agricultural people and veterinary people don't believe that. He's a very clever man, and one has to be very careful in arguing with him in public. You're not Jared Diamond by chance.
No, he's James Franklin. Right, so finally, you've done this volume, which takes you up to the gold rushes, and what are the challenges of the new information? As you said, there's a lot of new information that's affected your first volume from where you started many years ago. What do you expect the new information will be that will affect your second volume, which is really about the last, or roughly the last 200 years or thereabouts?
I think I'm finding not as much. Of course, I'm dependent more on myself in the second volume. The volume of new research in Australian history since 1788 is not having the same dramatic effects as the research is in pre-1788 history. But I think there are a lot of subjects which are still taboo in Australia or not very much researched. I was looking the other day, and I haven't finished doing it, but this is an example. It's widely said that the first federal constitution, the constitution makers in Australia said that the Aborigines weren't worth counting. And this statement is made again and again by Aboriginal activists, and one can understand them if it's true that they're not worth counting in a census in their own society. You know, this is a sign of the way they're despised. And I noticed the other day a textbook widely used by schools said it's a sign of the racism of the Australian people that they refused to count the Aborigines. I can't understand what they're talking about. The first census under the Commonwealth was held in 1911 by Sir George Nibsey, Commonwealth statistician, and he had specific instructions to go out and count Aborigines. The instructions came from the Solicitor General in interpreting the Constitution. And it seems to me, and I don't know enough about it yet, astonishing that a major cause of grievance and disharmony in a society should come from a statement like that that must have been spread widely.
So the point you're making is that Aborigines were counted, but they weren't counted insofar as the Constitution was assessed.
Well, in the Constitution, the only area where they weren't counted was in... originally, the Commonwealth received most of its revenue from customs, from the customs house. There was no income tax, and the Commonwealth surplus was paid back, if there was a surplus, to the states. And the idea was that if states had many Aborigines who were not part of the economy, why should they receive, that state receive income for that small proportion of people who were Aborigines? So it didn't say they shouldn't be counted. They shouldn't be counted in Commonwealth revenue. And interestingly, I haven't finished this, I thought, well, this is odd. There was only one census between 1921 and 1933, and quite clearly the Aborigines were counted in the 21 and between 1921 and 1947, and indeed there was a special census devoted solely to Aborigines in 1934. So I am puzzled that a cause of such ill will should be so difficult to pin down. So those are the kinds of things that I'm interested, of course, very much in European history in Australia. Yes.
Many thanks, Geoffrey Blaney. So as I said, Janet Grenner has got copies of Professor Brenner's latest book, The Story of Australia's People. I'll be very brief, there are a lot of people here, but without question, Geoffrey Blaney is one of our finest historians ever, and we've seen an example of his deep knowledge tonight. He's been one of those academics who's lived outside universities for many years and worked in areas such as business, has had an interest in religion, had an interest in Indigenous Australians going back half a century and beyond. So what we've seen today is a culmination of Professor Blaney's considered work over many decades across many subjects, culminating in this book tonight. And we'd love you to have you back when Volume 2 comes out. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.